Pull up a chair. I want to put you on a runway out in the high desert at Edwards, California. It's the middle of December 1986, cold morning. The kind of desert cold that gets into your knuckles, and there's an airplane sitting at the end of the longest runway in the country, and it does not look like any airplane you have ever seen. It looks like somebody built a glider and then couldn't stop building. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger. And on the hangar today, we're going to talk about the Voyager and the two people who climbed into a cockpit the size of a phone booth and did not climb out again for 9 days. Now, before I get rolling, let me tell you who keeps the coffee hot around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot. Instrument rating all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every one of them tells a story. And friend, this is a show about a story worth a coin. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. So, let's set the scene properly. Back in the early 1980s, there were three people sitting in a restaurant in Mojave, California. One of them was Bert Rutan, the airplane designer. The other two were his brother Dick Rutan, a retired fighter pilot with a whole career of combat missions behind him, and a young pilot named Gianni Yeager. No relation to Chuck, before you ask. I get that question every time. And the story goes that Bert grabbed a napkin, and on that napkin he sketched an airplane that could do the one thing nobody had ever done, fly all the way around the world, nonstop. And here's the part that matters. Without refueling, not once. Think about what that means. Every long-distance record before this one had a fuel stop in it somewhere. Every ocean crossing, every endurance run, somebody landed and topped off the tanks. What Bert was proposing was to carry every single drop of fuel you'd need for the entire trip around the planet. Right there with you, from the first turn of the propeller to the last. Now here's where it gets interesting. To do that, the airplane basically has to be a flying fuel tank. Everything else, the pilots, the engines, the structure, all of it has to weigh almost nothing, so that nearly all of the weight you carry off the ground is gasoline. So Bert built the thing out of composites. Carbon fiber, a paper honeycomb core, skins you could dent with your thumb when it was empty. That airplane weighed about the same as a small car, around 2,000 pounds, empty, but fuel it up for the trip and it tipped the scales near 10,000 pounds. Do that math. 3/4 of the airplane by weight was fuel. It carried it in 17 different tanks, spread through the wings and the body and the wing. Oh, the wing. It stretched out something like 111 feet, tip to tip. That's wider than a Boeing 727 airliner. On an airplane, you could practically lift by hand. The shape was strange, too. It had a little wing up front, what we call a canard, and two skinny booms running back, and a cockpit in the middle so small that the two of them could not both sit up at the same time. 7.5 feet long, a couple feet wide. One person flew while the other one lay down in a space about the size of a bathtub. For 9 days. Take a second and really sit with that. And it had two engines, one up front that pulled, one in the back that pushed. The idea was you'd run both for takeoff and climb when you were heavy. Then shut the front one down and just sip fuel on the rear engine for the long cruise. A little Continental in the back, purpose-built to run lean and run forever. All right, now walk back out to Edwards with me. December 14, 1986, sunrise. That airplane is so heavy with fuel that those enormous wings, which normally arch up toward the sky, are sagging, drooping down under all that weight until the tips are hanging low. And out at the very ends of the wings are these little vertical fins, the winglets, and they are hanging down so far they're almost touching the pavement. Dick and Jana climb in. They start the roll.
And this is the part that stops your heart. That runway at Edwards is 15,000 feet long, almost 3 miles of concrete, and the Voyager needed nearly all of it. The airplane is so heavy it does not want to fly. It's accelerating slow, painfully slow, and those loaded wings are flexing, and as it gathers speed, the winglets on the tips are dragging along the runway, scraping, grinding down the pavement. By the time that airplane clawed itself off the ground, it had used something like 14,000 feet of the 15, and both winglet tips had been ground off and torn away. They were just gone, damaged and hanging, and eventually they broke free entirely. Now put yourself in that cockpit. You are 90 seconds into a flight that's supposed to last 9 days, and you've already damaged the airplane. What do you do? They flew out over the desert, circled around, and Dick worked the airplane, put it into some gentle maneuvers to shake the wrecked winglet pieces off clean. Bert was down there on the ground looking up, chasing along in another airplane, and they made the call. The airplane would fly fine without them. Press on. And they turned west, and they went. Let me tell you what those 9 days were actually like, because this is where the romance meets the reality. It was loud.
That rear engine was right behind their heads, hammering away, no real soundproofing, because soundproofing weighs something, and they didn't have an ounce to spare. It was cramped past anything you can imagine. It was cold at altitude, and it was hot as blazes when the sun beat on that thin skin. They ate cold food, they were exhausted in a way that goes past tired into someplace else. Jeanne got beat up bad by turbulence at one point, bounced around that little cockpit.
And the weather, my goodness, the weather! Out over the Pacific, they ran up against a typhoon. Typhoon Marge. Now, most of the time, a typhoon is the last thing on Earth you want to fly near. But their weather team on the ground looked at it and figured out they could actually tuck in along the edge of that storm and let the circulation around it sling them along and give them a push. They rode the shoulder of a typhoon to save fuel. That is either genius or madness, and out over the ocean, there's not much difference. They crossed Africa. They dodged thunderstorms building over the mountains, threading between the buildups with an airplane. They did not dare stress too hard, because remember, this thing was built light, everything about it was built right to the edge. And then, near the very end, the moment that I think about the most, they're coming back across the Pacific toward the coast of Mexico, toward home, nearly there. And the rear engine, the one that had been faithfully pushing them around the entire planet, quits, fuel stops getting to it, and the airplane starts coming down. Sinking through the dark, out over the water, thousands of feet. Now the front engine, the one they'd shut off way back near the start of the trip, had been cold and dead for over a week, and they had to get it lit, and it would not catch. They're falling and they're cranking on this cold engine, dropping through the night, and finally it coughs, and it fires, and it catches, and it pulls them back up out of the descent. They got the rear one running again once the fuel sorted itself out, and they brought it home, December 23, 1986, 9 days, 3 minutes, and change after they'd left. They came back over Edwards and they put the Voyager down on the same desert runway they'd scraped their way off of, 26,000 miles all the way around the world, and nobody had ever done it, and nobody had done it since without stopping. You want to know how close to the edge they built that airplane? When the mechanics went to check the tanks after landing, they had something like 18, maybe 20 gallons of usable fuel left. On an airplane that took off carrying more than 1,000, after 9 days and 26,000 miles, they landed on fumes and a prayer. If that engine hadn't relit over the Pacific, we'd be telling a very different story. Now here's the thing I want you to take away, and it's the reason this one sits so close to my heart. The Voyager was not built by a government, it wasn't a squadron or a defense budget or a committee. It was three people and a napkin in a diner in Mojave. It was volunteers. It was built in a hangar out in the desert by folks who believed a thing could be done and then went and did it with their own hands. That's home-built aviation. That's the same spirit as the fellow out in his garage right now, hanging a wing on a kit airplane. It's just that these folks aimed it all the way around the world. You can go see her. You know, the Voyager hangs today in the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, up near the ceiling of that big entry hall. And right there in the same room hangs the Spirit of St. Louis and the Bell X-1 that first broke the sound barrier. That's the company she keeps. That's exactly where she belongs. Look at her hanging up there and you'll see, it's a fragile-looking thing, skinny and pale and strange, doesn't look tough at all, and I think that's the whole lesson. It's not always the biggest, loudest, most powerful airplane that does the impossible thing. Sometimes it's the lightest one, the one that carries nothing it doesn't need. The one built by people who cared more about the mission than about comfort. My thanks on this one goes to the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, and to Dick Rutan and Jeanne Jaeger themselves, who told the whole story in their own book afterward, and of course to Bert Rutan, who spent a lifetime proving the folks who say it can't be done just haven't met the right napkin.
There's more hangar talk waiting for you over at radiohangar.com whenever you want it. Next time you're taxiing out and your airplane feels heavy and slow and reluctant, I want you to think about two people scraping the wingtips off a paper airplane at Edwards and pointing it at the whole wide world anyway. Fly safe out there. I'll see you back at the hangar.